Hello, this is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Andy Nowicki. We're going to be discussing his latest work, Notes Before Death. Andy, it's so great having you back on.
Well, thank you, Robert. It's always a pleasure to be on with you.
So your latest work, Notes Before Death, it's a collection of three essays, but basically it ponders the sort of philosophical questions, what basically like the meaning of life and the role that death plays within our culture, within how it relates to the meaning of life, and how people deal with facing death.
Yeah, that sums it up, I think. The title track of the collection is a sort of essay, I guess, a sort of a personal reflection / ruminations, something that I wrote earlier this year. And the other two essays that I included with it, one called the Culture of Death, The Suffering God and the Culture of Death. That was something that I had originally published earlier, a few years ago. And there's also an essay about T.S. Eliot and his early poetry. And these the two things were sort of odds and ends that I wanted to find. I mean, they'd been published elsewhere, but I wanted to get them in a collection that was, you know, part of a wider, you know, thematically related work. And so since Notes Before Death itself, the title track of the collection, is on the shorter side. I think it's like 15,000 words, something like that. I included these other two works along with it, but I do think there's a certain through line, as you've said, with all three of these works, and that is the subject of death. And it's a subject, I guess, you know, has fascinated me as a writer for a long time. And here you have it. If you like death, you'll love this book.
Is the book explicitly geared towards looking at death from a Christian theological perspective, or is it more just looking at it as an individual?
Well, that's really the subject of as far as struggling with faith and dealing with certain aspects of the Catholic religion, and particularly the age-old issue of suffering and how do we reconcile our suffering with the existence of a loving God. That's really the subject of The Suffering God and the Culture of Death, the essay that I couldn't remember the title of a moment ago. That's the essay in which I really take a look at the notion of Jesus' suffering and you know, think about the whole concept of the suffering unto death that's recorded in the Gospels, and you know that's a part of the Christian doctrine as a way of understanding how you know, it's possible that, even though this is not explicitly stated anywhere that I know of, it seems to me possible and probable that, because it makes a certain degree of sense, that Jesus is suffering, again, for the Christian, and particularly for the Catholic. I'm, you know, representing the Catholic faith here, but really it applies to anyone who's Christian. The idea of looking at the suffering of Jesus as, in some way, that the ultimate paradox in that if Jesus was God, yet he suffered as man suffers, how does man suffer? Well, one aspect of man's suffering is wondering if his suffering is all for naught, wondering if life is meaningless, and feeling abandoned by God. And these are the things that Jesus, I theorize, you know, I don't have any absolute doctrinal standing on any of this, but I theorize in that essay that this is a way of reconciling man and God, in the sense that if God, if the idea is, you know, the famous oft-quoted phrase from the New Testament, God so loved the world that he sent his only son, blah, blah, blah. You know, if God himself became incarnated and then suffered in exactly the way that man suffers, that would mean that God would become man and doubt his own existence and feel abandoned by his father, which is to say another aspect of himself, and sort of the central paradox of Christian doctrine, but it's also what makes, it's also the genius of Christianity. I guess I could say it that way. Even if you're not a Christian yourself, it's something really strikingly unique about the Christian faith.
People's views of life are shaped by their view of the afterlife. If you look at religious people, traditionally a lot of religions have viewed, well, particularly Christianity, I'm not sure, other religions mm-hmm. have a different outlook on life, but Christianity, it's always been that this life is a test, and it's really the afterlife is what's important. And I think that was like that traditionally with Christianity, but a lot of modern-day Christians are very uncomfortable with death, and mm-hmm. people are very uncomfortable with accepting that death is inevitable. And if someone mm-hmm. is an atheist, then they believe once you die that this is it. So if someone's coming from an atheist perspective, they're going to have a very different perspective on life. I know you did discuss this book with Anne Sturzinger, who is, she's an atheist, so she is a very different, and you're a Catholic, but you do
I think she would say she was an agnostic, but you know, but something along those lines, yes.
You share some of the similar philosophical views towards life, even though you're coming at it from a different theological perspective.
Yeah, well, Anne's a friend of mine, and you know, we've gotten to know each other well, and we've read each other's work, and I've published a couple things through Anne's little publishing imprint, Hopeless Books. And Anne and I both share also having some kind of relationship with Catholicism. I'm a Catholic convert, and Anne was a cradle Catholic. She was a baptized Catholic, and now, of course, she's sort of fallen away from the faith. But I think if she were with us, she would say this too. She's never completely. Completely left her. I don't think it ever will completely leave her. Her Catholic sensibilities in certain ways and certain aspects. So I think that we both have a certain similarity in the emphasis on suffering. I've sometimes been told that my writings are depressing and that I dwell too much on human suffering. There's too much suffering and there's not enough joy, which I don't know, may or may not be true. I guess it depends on the reader, but that's certainly the case with Anne as well. There's you know, Anne is I said she was an agnostic, which sort of indicates a lack of belief or an unsureness about her belief, but she does subscribe to the philosophy of antinatalism, which is to say the idea that life is a burden, that life is a tragedy, and I don't share her antinatalist perspective, but I do understand it, and because there is an awful lot of pain, and there's a lot of suffering, and there's a lot of tragedy to life, and I feel like somehow it's part of my my lot in life is to be tuned in to this suffering, even if it's not emanating from me. I kind of sense it coming from out of the earth, if you will. I think we do share a lot of sensibilities, him and I.
So you start off in the book talking about your life, and you say as a child, you say that your innocent inborn hedonism was in fact tempered by a naturally calibrated moderation, though you wanted to have fun and in fact primarily live for fun.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about how as a kid you were very joyous in life, and
yes.
Then you talk about your experience in adolescence, and you say the springtime of youth is the cruelest season, as will not allow a boy simply to be alone with his newly discovered grief, won't allow his consciousness to die to the world. It must instead torment him mercilessly with intimidations, a brazen optimism, whispers of a promise better tomorrow, considerations, after all, in the words of the infernal Howard Jones, things can only get better. So basically you talk about the contrast of your attitude towards life from childhood to adolescence.
Yes.
And that theme of you get into that theme of how people are traumatized by adolescence, which is a theme in a lot of your work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had a really, really happy childhood. I had an ecstatically joyful childhood, it's something that, you know, the echo through my life, and it's something I can still, you know, I every now and then catch a certain scent of pine from the trees, or the way that it smells after it rains, or something, I don't know, some particular sense perception can just throw me back to what childhood was like, what things were like during that state of a state of mind before adolescence, before the clouds rolled in. And again, I have to be true to my sense of things, and I think that for me. And I get the sense that it's not just for me, but although it's maybe not always talked about or called attention to, and maybe it's, you know, overemphasized in my work, I guess that could be a criticism of it, but I really do feel like the coming of adolescence, the onset of sexuality, sexualization, which I talk in a book, That's Before Death, I speak of how it's, you know, the springtime, what it's like, you know, when there's this pollen that coats the air, this rank smell of, it's the semen smell, you know, that's everywhere, but spring is, we think of spring, it's supposed to coat, you know, joyful, happy, sort of perspective on things, that here's life rising anew from the death of winter. That's what spring is supposed to represent. But to me, I'm seeing the tragedy of it, the aspect of it that represents, you know, that not in life itself, but what comes from life when one is in a fallen state, in a fallen world. And that is, you know, the fall of the soul, the fall from grace. And for me, that's always very vividly represented with adolescence, with the coming of adolescence, and all that it brings with it.
You mostly talk about how adolescence shaped your view towards life. At that point in life, you weren't really aware of the concept of death. Most teenagers are at the stage in life where they feel that they're going to live forever. People don't really confront death till they get much older.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at what point in your life did you start to confront your own mortality?
Oh, well, I mean, I had a very vivid experience of, you know, confronting death, confrontation with death when I was 17 years old, and I had this, I don't think this incident is discussed in Notes Before Death, maybe recorded somewhere else, I honestly don't remember right now. I had a time when I thought I was having a heart attack when I was just 17, and, you know, actually went to the hospital and was checked, and there was no problem. There was nothing wrong with my heart. Somehow, you know, I just had this immediately visceral sort of panicked sensation of death being right there, right in front of my face. And so that definitely provoked a certain change in me, a change in perspective, transformation of consciousness, at least, you know, in understanding of things. I couldn't really put it away. I couldn't put it from myself. And so death had a kind of terror to it at that time. But what I talk about in Notes Before Death is almost the flip side of that, and that is I'm also aware there are times when death seems desirable, and, you know, like Keats writes in his Ode to a Nightingale, now more than ever seems it rich to die.
Talking necessarily in a suicidal sense.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I do have another book. That's somewhere else. Another book of mine, Considering Suicide, where I think about actually bringing death about by my own hand, the whole concept of it. Now, that's a part of the same thing, but
is
in
Considering
Notes Before
Suicide, is it a novel about, is there an actual character? Or is it more just discussing these issues philosophically?
Oh, in Considering Suicide, it's divided into two parts. And the first part is a narrative. It's a diary. You're reading a diary that's being kept by a man who's considering killing himself. And so it's called Diary of a Suicide. It's the first part of my book, Considering Suicide. And the second part of it is more of an essay, broadly speaking, of modernism, postmodernism, the erosion of faith and where it has left us in the world in which we now find ourselves. So, but yes, part of it is fiction, and there is a Dostoevskian sort of figure, as often happens in my work, who is thinking about bringing about his own end. But in Notes Before Death, it's not about suicide. It's about the whole idea that, because, you know, you get to a point where you realize you have responsibilities, especially if you're, you know, if you have children, as I do. You know, there's really, it's, you can't entertain. There's something monstrous about the idea of killing yourself when you've got children relying on you. I mean, no matter how miserable you are, you've got to push through it for them. But if you happen to die, you know, and what went through my mind sometimes is, you know, what if somebody just came up as I was, you know, working, sitting in McDonald's, drinking my iced tea, eating my chocolate chip cookies, somebody just came up and took out a gun and, you know, blew me away right then and there. I, you know, there was something about when I was in that state of mind, it was sort of like, hey, this doesn't even bring terror. There's a relief to this feeling. Or what if I suddenly have a massive heart attack, you know, which is what I thought I thought was happening to me when I was just 17. What if it actually happened? And, you know, there's a state of mind you get in where there's a relief to it. It's something that you positively even yearn for.
I mean, I brought this up earlier, but do you get into the different outlooks? Would you get into how your view on the afterlife shaped your views towards life in the sense of accepting death at this time? Were you thinking of an afterlife, or you're just thinking you're just going to die and that's it, and you're just dead?
Well, I have a hard time thinking that consciousness would just cease in every way. That's a hard thing for anyone to fathom. And in a way, it's just, I think there was some old Roman philosopher who said this, you know, that death is nothing to us because after we die, we're not there. If that's the case, then what's there to be afraid of? But I have a hard time. I don't spend too much time thinking about what heaven or purgatory will be like. Hopefully it won't be hell, you know. I've done enough to avoid that eventuality, but, you know, it kind of seems like a waste of time to try to concretely picture it, although Dante, you know, he did a pretty good job of picturing it in a way that was imaginative and interesting, so hats off to you, Dante. But for me, I don't really, you know, yes, I find I can't think that this is all there is. I just can't function thinking that. It doesn't work for me at all. And, you know, that's not to say that means that there necessarily is an afterlife. Having a need for it doesn't mean that it's there, but for me, it's definitely a necessity in my thinking. I guess that there are people who say, you know, I don't believe in anything but what's here and now. And so for them, the whole idea is just to hang on as long as you can and enjoy it as much as you can. But that philosophy just is so unappealing to me that I just reject it out of hand. I have a temperamental kind of rejection of that perspective. So I mean, that's, I think, what it boils down to for me. Is it's not so much thinking, yes, there must be an afterlife, and that afterlife must be, you know, this kind of, or it is saying, yes, there must be an afterlife, but it's not saying, not visualizing it or thinking it's going to be any particular way. It's just thinking, you know, this life is so paltry, and I can't, you know, if this is all there is, then, you know, it's just sands through the hourglass anyway. And that kind of ruins the enjoyment for me. You know, I want to have a sense of that there's more than that. There's something to hang on to. That's a real human need that we have, and that explains, you know, the persistence of faith. It's a psychological phenomenon in that sense. It's something that I think people just need. That's why people aren't happy in a post-faith world. Like we, you know, increasingly in the West, that's the kind of world that we live in.
One thing about modern society with, like, modern medicine, people are not confronted with death as much. In the past, death was accepted because people were dying early of illnesses. People were dying in war, but people sort of take it for granted that they're going to live a long life.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, it's become that, you know, that brave new world that Aldous Huxley forecast. You know, this world in which we just value pleasure and comfort over all things, and we're able to, because with advances in science, we're able to keep the unpleasantness of, you know, morbidity at a distance from ourselves. And yeah, that helps it. You know, it's a lot harder to do that when, I don't know, there's a plague ravaging the population. People are keeling over left and right, and, you know, in that kind of circumstance, death's right in front of you, and you gotta deal with it right then and there. But in a Brave New World kind of place, it's just a vague sort of thing that you know is there, but most of the time you can put it away from yourself.
Your last essay is about T.S. Eliot's poetry. It's called The Streets Hardly
right.
Understands. So you actually,
yes.
Did you write this back in 2011?
I think I wrote it before 2011. It was published in 2011 in Dappled Things magazine, where they inaccurately put me down as Andrew Nowicki. So even though my actual middle name is Anderson, my full name is Stephen Anderson Nowicki, but they just, I don't know, I just, my name on it was Andy Nowicki, that was what I sent to them, but for some reason they just thought they'd make Andy into Andrew, and they didn't ask me about that. Anyway, it got published in Dappled Things, which is I don't even know if it's around anymore, but it was a Catholic literary journal. Most of the time, mainstream Catholicism really wants nothing to do with me. But in this case, I guess they made an exception for some reason. So it got published there, but I wanted to include it in this collection, like I said, as a part of it was out there floating off on its own. I wanted to put it somewhere that was more solid and link it up to a couple of other essays that were thematically similar. Even though the essay about T.S. Eliot, you know, it's taking out a slightly different territory and it's more literary criticism. But it's still talking about Eliot, the poet as a young man, and the sort of things that were interesting or important to him as a young man prior to his famous conversion to Anglo-Catholic Christianity, and how
so
his poetry really changed after that.
Is it more about his life than the poetry itself?
Well, it's about the poetry itself, but it reflects on the man who wrote it as well. For instance, it's always interested me that a 23-year-old guy would write a poem like The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which is about this aging, this desperate man who's aging and wants to get more out of his life, but can't seem to will himself to disturb the universe. You know, why would a young guy write a poem like that? It must be an old soul, as they say. And that's kind of interesting. And so that final essay in the collection hones in on a book of Eliot's first ever book of poetry, the one that he first published in 1917, again, as a young man, called Prufrock and Other Observations, and it includes that book of poetry included the famous Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which is one of Eliot's most famous poems that most people have heard of, and it's a particular favorite of mine. And also includes a few other lesser known works that I also think are interesting, and I go into some. I get into some discussion of the poems, but I also reflect on Eliot as somebody that, you know, in some ways I could relate to. As you know, I connect his struggle with as a young man with my struggle, and you know, look at his work and consider how it changed after his faith, after he embraced faith. To me, his work did not change for the better. I actually enjoy his poetry considerably more before his leap of faith. And there's, I think because there's something interesting about, or something, you know, that strikes me as more truthful in a way about somebody who's just out there feeling his way along, struggling, you know, looking for something, trying to put it all together, but still, you know, still struggling. So that's sort of the essence of that final essay.
You talk about, in this essay, you talk about your personal life. So you talk about about Duran Duran, and you talk about their lyrics. And what you said is what you liked about their lyrics is that they were so obtuse, weird, and incomprehensible. A good example, Shake Up the Picture, the Lizard Mixture, with the Dance of the Eventide.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, and that's, I mentioned Duran Duran, and you know, early Duran Duran, it's still a favorite of mine. I still love
That's not from one of their more famous songs. That song is a little bit more obscure.
Well, it's New Moon on Monday, which was a minor hit. It's off the album Seven and the Ragged Tiger, their third album. But the reason why I mentioned them in that essay is because I, as an adolescent, I really gravitated towards the lyricism of Simon Le Bon, even though, you know, now I can obviously see its faults and see how it was just sort of weirdness for weirdness's sake and doesn't always, you know, sometimes just kind of slipshod and maybe not a lot going on besides just a bunch of obscure wordplay or whatever. But at the time, I really dug it. I thought it was cool. And then I read an interview with Simon, and he talks about being influenced by the obscure imagery of T.S. Eliot. And so it was through Simon Le Bon, through pop music, that I came, you know, to start to read one of the major poets. You know, I went from pop culture to high culture, let's just say. And it was through accessing T.S. Eliot and his writings that I really first, felt the stirrings of faith, or seeing the necessity of faith, because that was Eliot's journey, as I was saying a few minutes ago. And so I see it as, providence. And providence is it's something that we don't always see if you believe in it. It doesn't always slap you across the face. Sometimes things happen and there doesn't seem to be any particular reason for it, but one thing leads to another, and next thing you know, providence leads you home, leads you to where you need to be. And in this case, it was through liking Duran Duran, which I still like. The early work, I don't like anything after a particular time. But their first four albums are just terrific. I still like it, still recommend it. Not ashamed to say it.
In one of your other interviews, you said that you were actually teased in high school later on in the 80s for liking them because they were like several years old at the time.
Oh no, that was... Well, yeah, what you're thinking of is an incident in music class when, yeah, we were supposed to write down a favorite song. And, yeah, I picked a song that was it was like 1983, 84, I think, something like that. And so people were writing, or 82, maybe, because I think Physical by Elder Newton John and some of the songs were, you know, everybody was writing, it was in music class, which is kind of a waste of time. I don't know when I took it, maybe they've beefed up the program since then, but when I was back in elementary school, it was just something where everybody goofed off, and it was a waste of time most of the time. But anyway, this assignment was we were supposed to write our favorite songs on the board, and I said Grease. I had liked the the musical Grief, but the theme song by, what's it, Frankie Avalon, Grease is the Word. And I got made fun of for that. It was like, oh, Grease. I mean, it was like 4 years. That was 4 years ago. I mean, nobody liked that anymore. But if it had been 1978, you know, then that would have been cool. So it was just one of those things that, and of course now, you know, any of those songs that my classmates were writing on the board, their favorites would get laughed at for you know, being old fogies and, you know, not writing down any of the songs from 2015. So, you know, everything changes, but you just you like what you like. I mean, that's sort of the simple message I got from that whole
When you hear
experience.
A particular music, does it really relate like to a personal experience at life at where you were at that time? If you hear a particular song, what sense does that relate to your life?
Sometimes. I mean, you have certain songs that, I mean, this is kind of, I'm not saying anything really original here, but, you know, you connect, the human mind connects certain songs to, if not a particular experience, you know, but then a time in your life, like, say, it makes you think of the summer, or when you're out of school and having fun, you know, going to the pool and hanging out with your friends and, you know, carefree time, and you hear some song, and it just takes you back to that experience. I mean, that's sounding kind of trite, but I'm just saying that's an example of what I'm talking about. And then there's sometimes some other songs where you hear it and it takes you back to some particular experience, you know, not just something as vague as a season, but something, you know, much more particular and concrete. So music has that power, you know, and it's it definitely has a hold over the human imagination. It can cue us, and we get trained to react a certain way, to certain kinds of music, no doubt about it.
And in your essay on T.S. Eliot, you talk about, so T.S. Eliot uses sexuality as a metaphor for spirituality. A lot of that's also definitely a theme in your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he does, the Wasteland. I think that's the reference I'm making there, which is not it's maybe his most famous poem, certainly his most notoriously obtuse poem in a lot of ways. You know, it's a poem that represents the high water mark of modernism. And so there's, you know, all these references that are strung together. And, you know, it's very avant-garde. Even for its time, it was, you know, it was really, it caused a sensation that, but nobody was sure exactly what it all meant. And it represented a certain, you know, period in Eliot's literary life. But later on, actually, he seemed to be at some pains to distance himself from. But yes, in The Wasteland, it's really, you talked about it being like that the sexuality is representing spirituality, and it's more like withered sexuality representing spirituality that is wasted away in the modern world. There's all these images of impotence and joyless sex and so forth, and this is in the poem a representation of a joyless, spiritless world that, you know, the world that followed that after the collapse of faith. And so you say that's a theme in my work. I guess it is. I mean, I guess sexuality is definitely a theme, and faith is definitely a theme. And I guess they do, you know, they do coincide. They're both, you know, very, well, they're strong, strong sensations, let's just say. And they, you know, one can really be made to represent the other, you know, as a sort of manifestation of, you know, if you want to represent, as Eliot did, to represent withered spirituality, then, you know, a good concrete way to do that is to compare it to impotence or something like that. And also the opposite side, you know, when you're charged sexuality can almost have a spiritual feel to it in some ways, even though sometimes the two are at odds. I think in the most important ways, they are at odds.
Do you think in some cases can people feel, for some people, do you think nihilism can give people a spiritual sense, and for some individuals?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I don't know if you read Colin Liddell's recent article about this, the black pill.
Yeah.
Seems like something that you might like, Robert, that might be interesting to you. It relates to that question.
Yes,
I think that there is, I mean, to me, nihilism is something I've always eschewed. It's something I've never, you know, it's obviously a dead end to believe in nothing. But at the same time, there is something that's aesthetically very exciting about nihilism. And if you're a lunatic, it can be, you can perceive it as something that frees you to do the things that you know you really want to do, and to I don't know, to strive for some dark, twisted catharsis. I mean, you know, related to any of these crazy shooters like the one in Oregon. Of course, we seem to always end up talking about these kinds of guys. A little while ago, it was Elliot Rodger.
These people who, with nihilism, is for some individuals, it's a sense they feel liberated because morality keeps people from doing things. Morality, religion, ethical codes keeps people from doing things they might want to do. But for some people, nihilism can be liberating in the sense that it's preferable, they feel that it's preferable from conforming to sort of to norms of society that they view as being empty.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the appeal. I would say the aesthetic appeal of nihilism to me is part of the revolt against political correctness. I mean, when the norms are themselves so ridiculous as they are today, you know, and so tyrannical with such a totalitarian bent, as they are today with the unstated rules of what's called political correctness, or you know, the acceptable levels of discourse. And, you know, you embrace nihilism, and you look at these ideologies that rule today, but you see there's nothing really beneath them. What's the proper metaphor to use? They're built on air. You know, there's nothing really there. There's nothing substantial behind them. So you see that, and then you can just say, well, you know, you get to this point where you can just say, fuck your rules. I mean, I don't care if you think I'm a racist or a sexist or whatever. I'm not going to be bound, damn it. And
because
there's something really
think about every political group or cultural group, they have their own set of rules of what's acceptable and not acceptable. Mainstream society has its rules. Religion has its rules. Even the, like, alternative right movement and different has their set of rules. But the well, there's this whole sort of thing, like the 4chan site that the shooter was on, that segment of 4chan, the theme is kind of nihilism. Everything that society finds offensive is on there. Like, there is racist stuff, there is support for shooters, there's stuff involving underage girls, just every topic that people might find offensive is promoted, like, on within the people on 4chan. So it's just this theme that basically anything goes.
Right,
and I see that as I definitely see a growth in nihilist thinking. Maybe there's just a venue for it with the internet, but it could very well be an increase in that kind of thinking.
Yeah, I think that the internet, it could be both. I mean, there could be a growth. I think there's probably a growth in that kind of thinking, and also the internet gives channel to it, and that increases this growth, because through the internet, you're able to find people of like mind. I mean, in pre-internet days, you're probably too young even to remember those days. You had a certain kind of interest that was like, that went against the norm. Well, you know, you felt kind of alone. Where are you going to find somebody else?
I can actually remember the first time I used the internet. I think it was, must have been like nine, I must, I think I was in fifth grade. Must have been like 1996.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, for you, it's definitely always been a part of your adult life, and it's, you know, been a major part of your childhood and adolescent life as well. And for my kids today, it's, you know, it's always been there. But for me, there was a time when it wasn't, a long time, you know, all of my childhood, all of my adolescence, and a good part of my young adulthood, and there was no internet. And you know, it was harder to find people of like mind who shared your... Now, I mean, today you're interested in something. Usually you can just go and type it in the search engine and you find stuff about it, you know, no matter how obscure it is. You know, it's got to be really obscure for you not to be able to find it on Google. And there are some things that are that obscure, but they're harder to come by these days. And so... So, yeah, so in a way, you know, the internet helps us find other people who are interested in the same things that we're interested in, and it helps communities like 4chan, which I admit I've never visited 4chan. I think I'm maybe 15, 20 years too old for it. I mean, but it would still be interesting to witness sometime. But if it is the way you've been describing it and the way that I've heard about it elsewhere, you know, it sounds like a place where people go to just, you know, express themselves in a way that's obviously hostile to the prevailing norms.
I said, and if you go on a 4chan thread on that specific chan, it's a specific chan he was on, but you'll see, like, a post supporting, you'll see, like, support for shooters, support for terrorists. You'll see, like, racial slurs used a lot. You'll see talk about sex with underage girls, just all those things put together. Like some groups, like you might have some groups that are on the left who may be nihilist about some sexual issues, but uptight about racism. Then on the right wing, they'll be very moralistic about sexual stuff, but they'll have a racial agenda. But this is just, like, anything goes. There's no moral limitations.
Right. And, I mean, the left is pretty much rules the roost, I mean, these days. I mean, they are the mainstream. So the only way to rebel is to rebel against the norms of the left. And that's a very interesting thing that we're seeing today, you know, with the so-called, quote, edgelord phenomenon, which it's a term... You know, I didn't even know about until 8 or 9 months ago, maybe. or maybe even not maybe even sooner ago than that. You know, where you just, it's all about shock value. I mean, I think I understand the spirit of it very much. I mean, I think that there's something to be said for feeling completely unfettered and feeling like you can, if you find something funny, then, I mean, that's the thing about humor. Humor is completely anarchic. It's something that, there's no right or wrong to humor. It is what it is. If something is funny, then it's just funny, and you can't help it. you maybe don't want to find it funny, but it's, you know, to laugh is just an automatic response. And so, I think I understand the spirit and the appeal of a lot of these kinds of things, as long as you're able to keep it all in perspective. You know, it's just like playing violent video games. You know, some people get all, you know, they wring their hands over how violent video games are desensitizing our youth or whatever. But that's not really the case if you understand that a game is one thing and reality is a different thing. Making jokes about AIDS or 9/11 or whatever, these are funny things. If it's funny, then it's funny.
I noticed on one hand, political correctness has gotten more extreme in politics, but I noticed with comedy, there is sort of a shift towards nihilism in comedy. Like, you can see it on a show like South Park. Like, South Park makes fun of just about everything. Well, in the past, there were, like, strict limitations on what you could do in comedy.
Yeah, I think in the past when things weren't, there wasn't this same level of ideological tyranny. You know, even though there's still freedom of speech, the truth is that today you can, you know, get fired, have your life ruined for saying things that, you know, that would not have been a big deal even 15, 20 years ago. And so with that increase of repression, there has to be a safety valve somewhere else. And so it's coming out in more anarchic kinds of comedy where anything goes. I think that's the reason for it. I mean, there's obviously a correspondence there. One feeds into the other.
So in your work, you're coming at it from a Christian or Catholic perspective in your work, but at the same time you deal with a lot of dark themes. I thought this article would interest you. I'm sure you've seen it. It's by Richard Spencer's latest article called Christian Hollywood. And
yes,
he basically makes the case that like Christian movies or Christian Hollywood, like stuff put out by like Kirk Cameron and Nicolas Cage, it's basically like what you get from mainstream Hollywood, but without the swearing and a lot of references to Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, I've banged my head against that whole idea, and I wrote something a little while ago about this as well, where there's a certain Christian movie site Plugged In Online, and I had a piece that I wrote for Alternative Right a while ago, and then it got republished more recently, where I took on that I discussed that entire issue of, you know, certain censorious Christian critics who just say, oh, this is bad because it has a lot of violence, and oh, it's bad because it has swearing in it. People are rude to each other, and this, you know, that's no good. I mean, that's just negative. You know, they don't look at
the
real meaning.
There's plenty of violence in the Bible itself.
Oh yeah, yes indeed. And I in this Sex and Violence Traditionalism is the name of the piece that I wrote for Alternative Right. And in it, I talk about Flannery O'Connor, one of my favorite writers, who was a very devout Catholic and wrote these classic Southern Gothic tales where you know, with all kinds of, you know, disturbing, dark, violent events. And she justified it by saying, look, you have to try to reach people. I mean, it's the modern world. People aren't shocked by the kind of things that they're usually shocked by before. So she says, to the hard of hearing, you shout. For the almost blind, you draw large and startling pictures. And, you know, there's so my whole point is Christian art really doesn't have to be and really shouldn't be just treacly and squeaky clean and wholesome all the time.
Well, the thing is, throughout the past, there have been so many great, like, creative people, writers and artists who are Christians. But I notice today, like, Christian culture in America is seen as lame, so creative types tend to have a sort of knee-jerk reaction against Christianity. Like, the most creative people today tend to go in a more secular direction. I'm not sure if that's a global trend or if it's just sort of like there's sort of the Americanized version of Christianity. I mean, Christianity is going to be very different in, say, Europe, Russia, or the Middle East. It's just, maybe it's an American phenomenon. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's true. That some creative types, they see these kind of movies that Richard's making fun of in this article, and rightly so. He's right to make fun of them because they are lame, and they think, well, this is what Christianity is. Christianity is this mealy-mouthed, treacly, sticky, sweet, sickeningly wholesome, you know, not really acknowledging anything of the darkness of the world. And I mean, historically speaking, that, like you said, that's not what the Bible is like. There's all kinds of dark, disturbing, violent stuff in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, and the New Testament too, in Revelation and elsewhere. It's also that sensibility did not animate Christian art throughout its history. I mean, I talked about Dante earlier. You know, Dante's Inferno. I mean, that's pretty harsh. It's pretty hardcore. You know, if you read about that kind, the kind of ways in which people are being punished eternally. And Dante was a Christian writer. I mean, but today, you know, he would, if he tried to write the Divine Comedy, you know, with the Inferno being the first book of it, and it had the kind of content that it had in it then, this mealy-mouthed Christian establishment would turn up their nose and bristly, you know, react to, like, oh, this is awful. This is not true Christian art, when it is. I mean, there, and so, you know, I think it is, I don't know if it's a strictly speaking an American phenomenon. I'm sure something in American culture has contributed to it. You know, maybe evangelical
contemporary
culture.
Is these, like, if you go to the Bible Belt in America, they have these really, like, bland mega churches, but they're packed. But in Europe, you have, like, these really beautiful cathedrals, but a lot of those countries are actually empty, even though they have, like, stuff that's really inspirational.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, that's something that's been remarked upon many times, and it was, as I've said recently, that was a big concern of the man who used to be Pope, the man who retired from Popedom, whom I really liked a lot, Benedict XVI, you know, the erosion of spirituality, the erosion of Christendom in Europe, is a great tragedy for him. And it certainly is true. I mean, you go, I don't know if it's a post-spiritual world in Europe, but it is definitely very much, in many places, a post-Christian world, as far as, you know, the number of people who actually subscribe to Christianity or are regular churchgoers, very, very low. And America is kind of an anomaly in the West in that sense. There's, you know, and that still fairly robustly church-going country, although that's changing, I think, with the millennial, with your generation. There's maybe more more non-churchgoers than before, but compared to Europe, it's still very strongly faithful, or you know, proclaims itself to be a strongly faithful country. But you know, who knows? I mean, there's what people represent themselves as being is what they really are, as we all know.
We are out of time. Is there anything else about your book, Notes Before Death, that I didn't touch upon that you can mention?
Well, let me just say it's something that I published earlier this year, and it's a collection of three essays, and there is a through line through which all of them, they're all discussions of death and spirituality and the struggle for faith and the way in which death can sometimes have a pull. Sometimes it can be terrifying, and sometimes it can be appealing. We have a life wish and we have a death wish, and I just delve into all of that. So if this is the kind of stuff that thematically interests you, then check it out on Amazon. You can get it on Kindle or in paperback, and it's, I think, for very cheap, like something like $2 or $3, something like that. So check it out.
Andy Nowicki, thanks for being on.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.